now. So let me just give a brief introduction. Several people are not here today because we have various class trips. And the last session, which was 2 weeks ago, did not record. So I thought rather than move ahead with the Akedah, especially because so many people aren't here, and because the session didn't record, maybe we can go over some of the stuff that we did last time. I'll add a little. Yes?
Why doesn't Isaac's name change? Is it because
he's okay. Great question, and I will answer that in just a moment. Why doesn't Isaac's name change? I will answer that in just a moment. But is that okay for those of you who were here? If we go back over it? Okay. Now, let's go back to the Akedah. We'll review some of the stuff we did last time with some overlap for material that we're going to do this time. But I am projecting after this two more sessions, one, possibly three, and I'll tell you how they'll divide up. Next time we're going to do modern commentaries on the Akedah. The time after that we're going to do Kierkegaard and the Hasidim on the Akedah, or vice versa. Maybe we'll do Hasidim and Kierkegaard next time, modern commentaries after that, and then we will probably have enough material left for a fourth session on the Akedah and modern Israeli poetry and humor. We'll see how that works. Okay. Once again, because many people are missing today, we're going to go over some of the material that we did last time. And for those of you for whom this is a review, I hope it's good. So we're going to go over primarily rabbinic commentaries on the Akedah. Some stuff I'm going to condense so that I can get to other things that we didn't get to last time. But the subject matter is still the same. We opened with a question about why Isaac's name doesn't get changed when everybody else's name gets changed. And the prevailing view about that, although there is no single view, is that Isaac's name does not get changed because Isaac is the only one who's named by God, right? Abraham is called Avram by his father, so God changes his name to Avraham. Jacob is named Jacob by his father, so God changes his name to Israel. But remember, Isaac gets named by God because God is the one who said, Sarah, you did laugh, right? So they named him Laughter. And therefore, since Isaac started off with a name from God, Isaac's name doesn't change. That's at least the prevailing view. Okay. Now, let's go to chapter 22. And once again, the things that I mentioned last time, I'm going to go over pretty quickly. Then I'm going to add some rabbinic commentary. and hopefully that will bring us up to date for next time when we will continue probably with Hasidim and Kierkegaard. Let's go chronologically. And I'll talk about what that means. I mean, it sounds like I'm talking a foreign language, Hasidism and Kierkegaard, but I'll tell you next time what that's about. Okay. So, sometime afterward, God put Abraham to the test. Now, we don't know what happened before this, and Vayhi Achar HaDvarim HaEle, sometime afterward, is like a little bit like saying once upon a time. It lifts the story out of time. We don't know whether it's because Abraham had kicked Ishmael out of the house and therefore God was testing him so that he would know what it's like to lose a son. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the conventional understanding is that God is testing Abraham's faith. It could also be that God is testing the teaching that I once heard, actually, in the name of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, though I've not been able to find it, says that God wanted to know whether Abraham loved Judaism more than he loved God, because that's actually the choice between Isaac and sacrificing Isaac. Right? If you keep Isaac, what are you doing? You're perpetuating Judaism. That is the religion. But if you do what God says, you're showing that God actually comes before the tradition. And the reason that I think that's such an interesting comment is that we all have that dilemma. When we think that God is on our team, right, which is a very common perception, God doesn't like them, but God likes us, we're preferring Judaism to God. When we're told again and again, of course, that God is the God of everyone, and it isn't true that God, you know, God just doesn't like the Muslims, God likes the Jews. Or God just doesn't like the Christians, God likes the Jews. Or God really doesn't care much about the Chinese. despite the fact that he made a billion of them. God likes the Jews, even though he only made 12 of us, right? So there is that's the other possibility. There is one more, but I will get to that when we get to the modern commentaries. There's more than one more. I heard it in the name of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, but I've never been able to verify that comment. And I don't, unfortunately, can't find the source where I heard it. Because someone once asked me where I heard that a couple of years ago, and I scoured my notes, I couldn't find it. But anyway, he says to him, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. And that, of course, leads the rabbis to assume that Abraham argued. And so he said, take your son. He said, I have two sons, your only son. Each one's an only son by each mother. Whom you love. He said, I love both my kids. And finally, God says, Isaac. And there are two motivations behind that rabbinic comment. One is that Abraham doesn't say anything through the whole ordeal. Never says, God, I don't want to do this. Why are you asking me about this? It's not right. And so the rabbis supply Abraham's missing argument. And that's, you can understand that. It's the same thing that we do, actually, when you see a movie and you see a character in a situation and they don't say anything, you supply their internal dialogue. You say, he must be thinking this or he must be thinking that. So the rabbis do the same thing here, and that's one motivation for adding this dialogue to the text. The other is just that the text cries out for explanation. Why doesn't God just say, Isaac? Why does God say, your son, your only son, whom you love? It obviously increases the drama tremendously because you keep waiting for that inevitable. As soon as God says, take your son, right, you're already scared, even though we don't know exactly what God's going to ask. And then he says, and lech lecha. And when he says lech lecha, we are immediately transported to that beginning time of lech lecha, go you, in chapter 12. And we have that parallel. So he tells him to go to Moriah, though we don't know what Moriah is, and raise him up there as an offering on one of the hills that I will show you. It's depending on how you read this, and one of the ways that I'm going to read this later with you is the interpretation that Abraham knew that God did not want him to sacrifice Isaac. That's one possible reading of the story. If you want to read it that way, then when it says raise him up there as an offering, you note that it doesn't say kill him. It doesn't say go take Isaac and sacrifice him. It doesn't say go take Isaac and kill him. It says raise him as an offering. And here I'm reading, I don't know what the translation says, but it says offer him as a burnt offering. But ha'alehu, and ola is a burnt offering, but ha'alehu is raise him as a burnt offering. And it could easily mean offer him, but if you're looking for the story to be twisted in the way that Abraham knows that God doesn't really want to sacrifice, you could see it as raise him. Okay. Let me just pause here to say that once again, because a bunch of people aren't here due to class trips, we're doing a quick review of the Akedah in preparation for next time when we'll do the modern commentaries. All right. Abraham gets up in the morning, and here's, first of all, what I didn't mention last time was if Abraham gets up in the morning and God has just told him to sacrifice Isaac, when does God tell him? At night or in his sleep, right. In fact, the rabbis say that all the prophets get their prophecies at night or in dreams, except for one prophet. What prophet was great enough to see God in the middle of the day? Moses. Moses is the only one who sees God in the middle of the day, okay? And the idea that it was a night vision makes it murkier, more mysterious, or, as you'll see when we get to some of the modern philosophers, more questionable, you know? I mean, you can just imagine his bringing Isaac up the mountain. He says, why are you doing this? He goes, well, I had a dream, you know? Although, as you know, in the ancient world and in much of the modern world, dreams are taken very seriously, as prophecy. A dream uninterpreted, says the Talmud, is like a letter unopened, which is an interesting way of thinking about it. So he saddles his donkey, and he takes two young men with him, and Isaac, his son. Now, that emphasis on Isaac being his son is something that's going to be repeated again and again in the story, okay? That Isaac is his son. It doesn't just say takes Isaac, it's Yitzchak beno, Isaac his son. Why does he have to say his son? I mean, we know that Isaac is his son. We just read previously. Once again, the idea is that the Bible is subtly telling us things that are important for us to understand the dynamic of the story. That is, he's really, you know, Abraham is not neglectful of the fact that Isaac is his son, and that we as readers should not forget that he's asking to sacrifice his son. And he cleaves the wood for the burnt offering, or he splits it, and vayakam vayelech, he gets up and he goes to the place that God told him. And here, we have to wonder also, why does Abraham take two young men with him? To carry provisions, to help protect him on the way, to be his witnesses for what he does. It's not clear, although in the end, of course, he will have the young men wait at the bottom of the mountain. They won't come up with him. And I'm going to talk about coming down the mountain in just a minute. Okay. Now, we talked about this at great length. I'll just make a quick comment about it. On the third day, Abraham lifts his eyes and he sees the place from afar. We don't know what happened on those 3 days. We have no recounting of it, although the Midrash has a long recounting of it. And in fact, there is in the Midrash, and again, the Midrash is rabbinic tales, there is, since the rabbis by and large read this as, this is the great act of Jewish faith, which is why you read the Akedah on Rosh Hashanah and you read the Akedah every morning in the prayer service in traditional liturgy. This is the greatest act of Jewish faith. Because of that, they see the forces of evil in the world as wanting to thwart Abraham, as wanting to oppose his carrying it out. So, in fact, what the Midrash says happens during those 3 days is Satan, right, who is not really a factor in the Bible, but is in rabbinic literature, keeps trying to block Abraham from doing it. And Abraham has to continually overcome obstacles because he is single-minded in his desire to carry out God's command, right? Which is horrible to us. You would think he would take any excuse to say, you know, God, I really wanted to do it, but I was blocked. But the whole point is that according to the reading of the Talmud, and we'll talk lots more about how to see the whole story, but according to the plain reading of the Talmud, it's not possible to say that God commands something wrong. That's an oxymoron, right? It contradicts each other. It's like saying long shortness. Because if God commands it, it must be right because God commands it. And our vision of the world is narrow and limited and fragmentary. It's nothing compared to God. The way that I, you know, often explain, not the Akedah, because I don't teach it to high schoolers, I never have that I remember, but the way that I explain the whole, the God-human idea is the tradition envisions it something like this. When you were 10 years old, or 5 years old, or 2 years old, you had no idea what it was to be an adult. You thought you did, but in fact, being an adult, you realize when you're a four-year-old imagining an adult bears no relation really to the world that you're in. Now, according to the Jewish tradition, God is infinitely greater in proportion to us than we are to four-year-olds. So for us to say what God said is wrong makes as much sense as a four-year-old saying when he gets a shot, this is wrong. So for the tradition, to say the Akedah is wrong betrays just how much lower we are on the spiritual scale than Abraham. Abraham knew that God said it, therefore it must be right. So it's a test, but Abraham knows what the right response is. Now, I don't want to get into this discussion. There are lots of other readings of this, and we will talk about them. But I just want to say that to explain why, for 3 days, Satan could put obstacles up and Abraham could believe his only job was to overcome the obstacles, because God told him to. And there is nothing more comprehensively commanding than that. How he knew God told him to is a question raised by some modern philosophers that we will come to. He comes to the third day, and he raises his eyes, and he sees the place from afar. Every now and then what happens is that some of the other readings, the modern and Hasidic readings, are blending over, and I'm trying to avoid mixing the various time periods. But for those of you who know, Makom is also a name for what?
God.
So when he sees God from afar, Makom Merachok, the Hasidim say, you know, when he goes up the mountain, then he comes close to God. But so far, he's only seeing God from afar, right? So Avraham says to the young men, to the lads that he brings with him, stay here, im hachamor, and I and the other na'ar, that is my son, will go there and we'll bow down and we will return to you. Now, if you want to read this as Avraham does not sacrifice Isaac, this is the key line. Right, we will return to you. But I have a chilling reading for you from Bachya, Rabbeinu Bachya, who's a medieval commentator, because they obviously did not, most commentators did not read this as Avraham in fact saying we'll return. They assumed what Avraham was doing was what? Why does Avraham say we'll return? Yeah, he doesn't want that. I mean, he doesn't want to say, okay, I'm going to go up there, I'm going to kill my son, I'll be back, please wait right here. So instead he says, you know, we'll go up there and we'll return to you. But Rabbeinu Bachya says that he was speaking somewhat literally because he was going to bring Isaac's bones down the mountain. Ooh, but he's reading the story, you know, the way it's written. He says, he assumes that Abraham doesn't lie and that Abraham is going to sacrifice Isaac and he's not going to leave Isaac up on the mountain. I mean, you probably never thought about this, but what do you do with the remains of a human being that you sacrifice, right? He's going to bring him down, he's going to bury him. So when he says, we will return, that's Rabbeinu Bachya makes that comment, which also tells you how much a traditional commentator, if they're good, actually envisions in their mind the story. They really think about what's going to happen. You know, the same way that if you read a book and you read it properly, you really try to see in your mind what's going on with the characters so that you can understand what the author is doing. Yeah?
Well, how much of the remains are there for a burnt sacrifice?
He said the bones. The bones, yes, there are bones remaining. There isn't flesh, there isn't blood, but there is bone. So, yeah. Remember, I just want to say, to cremate remains takes a tremendous amount of heat. So, yeah.
Can you review a little bit the intersection of the Akedah with paganism and the idea of human sacrifice?
Yes, we're going to talk about that more, especially when we come to modern commentators. But one of the readings of the reading that I learned of the Akedah, I remember from Simon Greenberg. This was his conviction, although most modern commentators don't agree with him. And it's a long tradition of this, is that the Akedah is intended to repudiate human sacrifice. That is, why does Avraham go along with this? Because he lives in a world in which humans are sacrificed all the time. And we know this, by the way. We found not only from many passages in the Bible where others, like Mesha, are sacrificing human beings. And I'll show you one or two of those passages. And from the fact that the Bible mentions human sacrifice a lot, John Levinson wrote this whole book about human sacrifice in the Bible, but also we found archaeological remains of altars where people sacrificed humans. So when God says, sacrifice your son, maybe Avraham doesn't think this is so crazy. This is what gods do. And the point of the story is to say, when God says, don't do that, God doesn't work that way. That in fact, he he wants to emphasize that this is not a command that God will ever make. Yeah. It's not. You're not allowed to cremate in Judaism. The body has to return to the dust. Yeah.
I just wanted to share, when I've read this story, even now when we're reading it, I'm always struck by the slow pace, the very deliberate pacing of the story. Like, there's 3 days, and all the little details, I'm going to go up, I'm going to come back. All the details, there's nothing in a rush, you know?
And no, that's
you know,
that, well.
Compressed, there's this feeling of a sort of a hushed, very deliberate, almost as if he's taking a very slow step to really check this out.
Well, save that comment because I'm going to talk to you about the most, I don't know if I brought it this morning, but I'm not ready to talk about it yet anyway. There is an article by Eric Auerbach, which is probably the classical article on the style of the Akedah. It's called Odysseus's Scar, where he compares the Akedah to a passage from Homer, from Homer's Odyssey, and he talks about the stylistic peculiarities of it. So hold that, unless you wanted to make a specific point at the end. Go ahead.
My point being that when God says, don't do this, to me, that this feeling in this story, which is a very different feeling almost than other stories, this very careful, detailed, slow pace, starts to make sense because he has to go through all these motions of preparing the human sacrifice like other cultures around him to really understand, no,
not to do it.
This is not the way I want. Almost like it's a, such almost an ingrained.
Well, that's the way that Greenberg reads it. And there's a long tradition of reading it that God is making the point that you don't do it.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't say sacrifice is wrong, but it clearly says
human sacrifice. It just says, well, you don't need to do it now, I know that.
Right, right. Although it is clear in there are about 20 different passages in the Bible that condemn human sacrifice. It doesn't do it here, but there are many other places that do, and this could be the narrative corollary to those comments. But I think, look, there's so much interpretation of the Akedah that you're right, it's sometimes hard to disentangle what's interpretive from what seems obvious. And I would say that the first reader of this, coming to this new, it would not seem obvious that the point is that human sacrifice is bad, right? It would seem obvious, in fact, that the willingness to sacrifice a human being is good, but Abraham didn't have to do it. But it also is true that the first meaning of a story is not always the ultimate meaning, so we'll have to say that, yeah. Well, that's we're going to get to that when the question becomes whether Abraham knew or didn't know about whether he would sacrifice. Although Mark Twain appropriately said that the only people who should say we are editors, kings, and those with tapeworms. Anyway, so because you know that there are always people who, like politicians will never say I, always we. When we become president, you know, as though... all right, so Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and put it on his son Isaac. And once again, this is echoed in the New Testament when Jesus carries the cross, right? And there are clearly the New Testament uses the Akedah as one of its models, right? The sacrificial lamb, that's the ram that gets sacrificed in the end, as well as scapegoat and the Akedah. All of it plays into the story, to the narrative. So he takes the wood. Now, but if you think about it for a minute, and it says, V'yelchu shnehem yachdav, the two of them walked off together. John Levinson points out that yachdav really could mean as one. The two walked as one, which suggests, as it will in a moment, that Abraham and Isaac are of one mind about this. That it's not that Isaac is unwilling, that Abraham is doing this unwillingly. Although you must ask yourself then, and we will return to this in just a moment, so why does he tie Isaac up? Right? Akedah, in Hebrew, it's not called the sacrifice of Isaac. It's called the binding of Isaac, because Isaac is not sacrificed. Right? So, we'll see. But there is pathos, there is really, it's a very powerful thing to imagine Isaac with the wood on which he will be bound walking up the mountain, right? However old he was, and I think the clear sense of the story is that he's 12, 13, 14, around that age. In fact, that comes from the dialogue that we see. So God says, so Isaac says to Abraham, father, avi, and Abraham says what? Hineni b'ni. Now hineni, as I pointed out last time, and Levinson points out, is better translated ready than here I am, right? Ready means I'm fully available. Hineni is the same word that Abraham said to God when God called him at the beginning of the story. It's the word that he uses with Isaac, which means that he is as responsive to Isaac as he is to God. This is Heschel's definition of a prophet. A prophet is somebody who holds God and man in one thought at all times, right? That they're never sacrifice one for the other. And so it's interesting to imagine that Abraham feels, and he not only says, here I am, but he says, here I am, my son, emphasizing the relationship between the two.
How can we think of him as a child, when we know that the math tells us that he's...
Well, it depends how you do the math. There's lots of different ways of doing it. The math tells you he's 37, depending on when Sarah dies. That's the question. The question is, if Sarah dies right after the Akedah, then he's 37. And that's the usual assumption. But, you know, there is this principle, Ein Mukdam U'Mukhar B'Torah, which some of the commentators use sometimes. There's no early and late in the Torah. In other words, the Torah doesn't follow chronological order. And even though some of them, like Nachmanides, Ramban, tries very hard to prove that the Torah does follow chronological order, he has to sometimes really twist himself into knots to get himself there. So I don't know. I don't have a better answer than that. All I can say is that it seems that the feel of the story doesn't work with a 37-year-old. But anyway, here are the firestone and the wood, but where's the sheep for the burnt offering? Now, this is a practical question. They're going up there. They're going to do a sacrifice. Okay, so where's the sheep? Now, Abraham says, God will see to the sheep for his burnt offering, my son. Okay? This is where, according to the rabbis, and according to most readers of the story, Isaac knows. And the reason that you put it here is because, first of all, Isaac must know at some point, and we're never told this is when Isaac found out. So this is when Isaac knows, but again, you could read this as Abraham's statement of faith. That Abraham really does believe that God will provide a sheep, that he's not lying and he's not dissembling and he's not signaling Isaac, you know, wink, wink, God's going to provide a sheep, Isaac, my son. But he really does believe that God will, because he can't believe, yeah.
But a sacrifice, you give up something of value. Here he's not, Abraham's not going to give it.
Well, if you find a ram or a sheep, that's a value. Right, ram and sheep is like, you know, that's
God's sheep.
But in the ancient world, if you find a sheep or you find a ram, that's a very valuable thing. So it's worth a lot of money. That's how currency. I mean, money. You know, there isn't paper money or coins. There's property, and property is.
It says ahead of time that God's going to supply it.
Right.
God's going to give the sacrifice.
God will give him something valuable that he will then have the choice to give back to God or not.
Isn't
right.
That why Isaac knows.
That's the idea is that Isaac knows just because there's no moment at which God says it, but you could say that Isaac knows just because it's pretty far-fetched to assume that when you get to the top of the mountain, there's going to be a sheep wandering around there. That's true. Although, well, I that actually comes to something very nice, and I'll mention this when I come to the end, and I'll return exactly to that point. So they arrived at the place which God had told him. How they knew that, it doesn't say. Abraham built an altar there. The Midrash, by the way, assumes that there's a cloud around the mountain. He builds an altar there. He lays out the wood. He bound his son Isaac, laid him on the altar on top of the wood, and picks up his knife to slay his son. Now here, it's pretty unambiguous. It says, lishchot et beno, and shchita, shochet, it's all from the same word. So it seems that Abraham's intention here was to do that, okay? Unless you want to say, unless you want to say it in the way that, like, if you put me in a batter cage against a major league pitcher, you would say, I picked up the bat to hit the ball, but there's no chance on earth that I'm really going to hit the ball, right? So the same thing. I mean, maybe he picked up the knife because that's, you know, it's a slaughtering knife, but that was not. An angel of the Lord calls him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. Again, I reiterate Wiesel's comment that, you know, God, only God can command you to take a life, but even an angel is good enough to save, right? Which is when you wonder, why doesn't God specifically, since God gave the command. And he answered, here I am. Okay, he says, now, here's the comment that I was going to make before. He says, don't raise your hand against the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you haven't withheld your son, your favored one, from me. Actually, a comment before I make the comment I was going to make. Eric Welish, who's a modern commentator, is a psychiatrist, wrote a book called Isaac and Oedipus. And Isaac and Oedipus. It's about the idea that, in fact, in the Bible, unlike children, you know, the Oedipus complex is about how children want to destroy their parents. He says the Isaac complex is about how parents destroy their children. And he talks about several different episodes in the Bible. And we all know that it's true. It works both ways, right? Children and parents and children. It's a very fraught relationship. He says the key verse in this story is right here. Okay? What does he say in 12? Don't raise your hand against the boy or do anything to him. That's the message of the Akedah, is don't do anything to your children. In a bad way, obviously. Right? That this, the Akedah, is a story to parents about the ways in which we damage children, and the essence of the story is don't do anything to them. And God is rewarding Abraham for not destroying his child, as so many parents do. Which is a really interesting psychoanalytic reading of the story, and we will, again, we'll return to that. But I just, since we were at that key verse, I wanted to mention it. Okay, Abraham looks up, his eye fell on a ram caught in a thicket, just happens to be there, and I'll read you later the Yehuda Amichai story where he says the real hero of the Akedah is the ram, because he's the only one who doesn't go home. It's a great fact. You know what, as long as I mentioned it, let me read you, it's a very quick poem. I brought a bunch of poems on the Akedah. Here's the one from Yehuda Amichai. Where are you? Where'd you go, Yehuda? Who was the, probably the greatest modern Israeli poet after Bialik, but Bialik is not, he's a modern Hebrew poet, but not exactly a modern Israeli poet. So this is Amichai's poem. It's called The True Hero of the Akedah. The true hero of the Akedah was the ram, who didn't know about the pact among the others. It was as if he volunteered to die in place of Isaac. I want to sing for him a memorial song about the curly wool and the mortal eyes, about the horns that stood silent on his living head. After the slaughter, they were made into shofars to sound the blast of their wars and to sound the blast of their base celebrations. I want to remember that final image like a pretty photograph in a fancy fashion magazine. The tanned, pampered youth in his finest of frocks, and by his side the angel dressed in a long silk gown as if for festive reception. And the two of them with desolate eyes looking out to two distant, desolate places. And behind them, as a colorful background, the ram, entangled in the thicket before slaughter, the thicket his final friend. The angel departed homewards, Isaac departed homewards, and Abraham and God had parted a while back, but the true hero of the Akedah was the ram. Some poem, huh? He was amazing. Okay. And Abraham named that site Adonai Yireh, whence the present saying, on the mount of Lord there's a vision. Okay? Now here's the, we were talking at the very beginning about how when you don't have the answer to something, you want to, you know, when you read a commentary, when you read the Bible alone, so many questions arise, and how do you know if it's a real question or if it's just something that you asked but isn't, you know, has an obvious answer, whatever. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I swear, the Lord declares, because you have done this and not withheld your son, your favored one, I will bestow my blessing upon you, and he gives him all these blessings, okay? The blessings, by the way, that echo, bless you, the blessings at the beginning of the story, and they also echo a blessing later that we'll talk about. So the question is, when does God bless Abraham? He does not bless him with all this stuff after he stops the sacrifice from Isaac, he blesses him after he sacrifices the ram. Okay? And Levinson notes this in his book, but he doesn't have a reason for why God blesses him after the ram and doesn't bless him after he stopped from, he says, maybe the carrying out of the sacrifice. So I was reading Tosefet Bracha, who is a modern commentator, and he makes the very interesting point that the ram was a voluntary sacrifice. He says, God doesn't say, go sacrifice that ram. He says, sacrifice Isaac, and then he stops it. Abraham sees the ram and decides to sacrifice it on his own. So God is rewarding him, says Tosefet Bracha. That's the name of the book. His name is Rabbi Baruch Epstein, but he was from the, he lived in Pinsk in the 19th century. He says, God is rewarding him for the voluntary sacrifice that he made. That's why, Jules, I said it goes back to your point. And not for the sacrifice that he commanded him to make. Okay? So I emailed that to Levinson, who said, you know, it's a nice drash. It's not pshat. That is, it's not the plain meaning of the text, but it's a very nice rabbinic homily. The other way in which you know whether a question is a good question is in some ways whether it's been taken up by commentators. If there's a question on a very well commented story that hasn't been taken up, it's probably not really a question. And I'll give you an example. You know, at the beginning of this story, it says aseh le'olah, that you're going to bring up aseh, and then at the end he sacrifices an ayil. He doesn't sacrifice a seh. And someone asked me this. I actually got a letter from a Christian in the Midwest who says, why does it start off with a seh and it ends up with an ayil? And the truth is, never thought about it, never saw a comment on it. So I searched through the commentaries and I could not find a single commentary that mentioned it, which I thought was bizarre. So I emailed a couple of people here and in Israel for answers. And I got one not very good answer from a yeshiva in Israel. Was that the Rambam says every sacrifice that is an olah must involve a seh. So they wanted to give the general category of seh, and then it told you what specific one it was, which I thought was a little weak, you know. But I got a very good answer from a biblical expert at Yeshiva University, Sid Lehman, who said a seh is actually a broad category, like saying a mammal, although not quite equivalent, and the ayil is then the specific of it. So God's saying, go up there and sacrifice, you know, a four-legged mammal that is legitimate for sacrifice, and Abraham sees a ram and sacrifices it. And I then, in fact, found in another article later, a modern article, the same explanation. So it's very tough sometimes to track down. You know, this took several emails to find, and so I wrote the guy back, and I included a copy of the email. But you don't always get the answers that you expect. I never would have guessed that I was going into animal husbandry. Okay, so that's a quick review now of the rabbinic commentary on the story. Let me just finish off with the very end of this. An angel of the Lord calls to Abraham and says, by myself I swear. It's a weird translation in the English, but it's actually a fairly legitimate translation. It means I myself promise. Bi nishpati ne'um Adonai. So the Lord declares, because you've done this and not withheld your son, your favored one, I will bestow my blessing upon you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars of the heaven and the sands of the seashore, and your descendants shall seize the gates of their foes. All the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by your descendants because you've obeyed my command. Now, two quick points with which to close, and then we'll take questions and comments. One is, what is Abraham rewarded for? One reading is that Abraham is rewarded for the willingness to sacrifice his son. As we will see when we get to Kierkegaard next time, Kierkegaard and some other readers of the Bible read this as, it's not that Abraham is rewarded for sacrificing his son. Abraham is rewarded for believing and trusting that God will carry out his promises no matter what Abraham does. Remember, God has already promised him, you're going to be numerous as the stars of the sky. So the logical thing for Abraham to say when he says sacrifice his son is not, how could you ask me to do such a thing, but you already promised me I was going to be numerous through Isaac. So if I kill Isaac, it's going to put a crimp in the plans, obviously. I'm not going to be able to be numerous through Isaac. But Abraham doesn't say that, which shows that he believed God even in spite of what God had told him he was going to do, which is a different, notice those are two different things. One is he's getting credit for doing something horrible because God told him. The other is he's getting credit because he still believes God's promise even in the face of what seems to contradict it. And that will lead to two different ways of reading the story, and both of them make sense, right? Both of them make sense. You could be either one. And then, most interesting is, I'll see if I can find the, notice what it says in verse, where is it? Verse 17, okay? Read that verse. What are you going to do? And then I have to find, you're not only going to be blessed, but you're going to do what? You'll seize the gates of your foes. Where is it? I have it written down somewhere, but let me see if I can just find it. Yeah, the gates of your foes. Oh, here it is. That expression occurs only one other time in the Torah, and it occurs a couple chapters later, chapter 24, verse 60. Okay? Chapter 24, verse 60. Abram sends his servant to go find a wife for Isaac. He finds a wife for Isaac. Her name is Rebekah. Rebekah is sent off from the house of her father, Laban, and he says to her in verse 60, and they blessed Rebekah and said to her, Achotenu, our sister, may you grow into thousands of myriads. La'alfei revavah. The same thing you say, by the way, to a bride at a bedeckin right before a wedding, right? You give this blessing. May your offspring seize the gates of their foes. Now, why is it you think that one echo exists in that story? Because it is the fulfillment of God's promise, right? Here is the woman who is going to have Isaac's child that is the promise that God gives at the end of the Akedah. Okay, that's chapter 24, verse 60. Okay, 60, not 16, 60. One second. Okay. So, Betuel, who is her father, who is her father, and Laban, who is her uncle, the two of them bless her with the same blessing that Avram gets at the end of the Akedah. All right, so let's stop there. Next time I will do Chassidim and Kierkegaard, but I have a couple of, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so kind of a two-part question.
Yes. Right. Right. Yes. Yep.
Second, there's further irony because while that blessing in theory sounds so blessed, his wife hears this news about what happened and falls over and drops dead.
Mm-hmm.
And there's interpretation that his relationship with Isaac is severed from that.
Yep.
Those that he holds closest to him, he no longer has.
Well, there isn't, the interpretation that his relationship with Isaac is severed, we'll talk about, but it doesn't say that explicitly. However, this is the moment. I would say it this way. If you want to follow this reading, first of all, it's true that Sarah dies, but she dies at a good, we should all reach Sarah's age. But what? But I would say that you can also, the way, if you want to follow this reading, that Avraham loses his relationship with Isaac, that Sarah dies because of it, the flip side of that is, here we are 3,000 years later talking about what Avraham did. So, in fact, in order to do something great in this world, it often costs you close relationships, and all you have to do is read the biographies of great men. You know, biographies of Einstein just came out and reinforced the fact that, you know, you don't want to be Einstein's wife because he basically turned her into a servant. She was there to accommodate his every need because he was Einstein. You know, I guess that there's a price to pay for the general theory of relativity, and there's a price to pay for the Akedah. I don't think that anybody believes that you can do something so powerful and so dramatic and not have it in one way or another impact the life of those around you. Which is why, by the way, you know, Cyril Connolly, who is an English writer, wrote this book called Enemies of Promise. It's interesting in his own life, too, because he said that the only function of a writer is to produce a masterpiece, and he never did. But Enemies of Promise is all about the things that prevent a writer from producing, I mean, part of it is all about the things that prevent a writer from producing a masterpiece. And you know what number one on the list is? What he calls the pram in the hall. A pram is English for a baby carriage, right? Because, you know, it's very nice to say, I'm in here, I'm producing a masterpiece, but if you've got a kid outside, and presumably a spouse who's taking care of that child, there are demands on your time. And there is a constant, you know, back and forth between the two. And you don't want to be, I mean, this is Picasso, Beethoven, Mozart. You can go through the personal lives of any number of geniuses and discover that it is a rare genius who is actually gentle and kind and, you know, always decent and... There are some, but they're not the majority. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk about the connection between the Akedah and circumcision.
I don't know that there is actually so much of a connection between the Akedah and circumcision, because Abraham is commanded to circumcise earlier. He circumcises Isaac earlier, he circumcises himself earlier. You can say that there's a connection between the general idea of sacrifice and circumcision, that it is a sort of mini enacted sacrifice, and that it is a sign that in some way the child belongs to God and as well as to human beings. But I'm not sure that the Akedah, I have to think more about it, I'm not sure that the Akedah is specifically directed towards circumcision, though clearly the theme of taking a knife to your son is, you know, ties them together powerfully. Yeah.
Last time you said, line 19, Abraham had returned to his servants alone.
Yes.
Who was the commentator who points out that Isaac doesn't come down?
Sfat Emet. The Sfat Emet. All the commentators note the name. The Sfat Emet is the one who says, the Sfat Emet was the Gera Rebbe. He's the one who says that this is indicative of a break in the relationship between Isaac and Abraham. They all notice, the rabbis notice, that he comes down alone. I mean, every reader of the story does. What the rabbis say, the rabbis of the Talmud, is that he went off to study at the yeshiva of Shem and Ever, two earlier characters in the Torah. They don't suggest that it's a function of a break. They suggest that Isaac goes off to study. That he was sacrificed and resurrected.
Right.
It's a midrash that you find in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, which is like an 8th century midrash. That's where you find that idea. Which is where Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer is a strange midrash in a lot of ways. It also has a midrash on the book of Jonah that's it's entertaining in a way. Where, remember, the sea is very rough, and the ship is going to go over, and they finally throw Jonah in, and it calms the sea. In Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, they take Jonah, and they dip him into the sea, and it calms, and they lift him up. And it gets rough again. They dip him into the sea, and it calms, and they lift him up, and finally they say, okay, well, there's nothing we can do, sorry, and they throw him over. But anyway, it's an interesting midrash. Yeah, Mark.
I actually, the message that this is the people that, you know, instead of sacrificing their children, which was common then, to sacrifice a sheep. But if that was the message, how come it was done in such a private, you know, the servants were down there, there was just two of them, there was nobody to really witness this, to see, to get a...
Well, all I would say is that the story is told, and the story is supposed to be the witness. You're right, nobody sees it, but once everybody knows the story, it's the witness for generations. Because it is true, and it's a good point, that a lot of the things that happen in the Bible happen privately. But I mean, things that go on between God and Moses. But they're reported, so that's how they have an impact. Yeah.
My question is related to what Mark is saying, that although I see contradiction, that God sanctioned the throwing out of Ishmael from Abraham's house.
Right.
And here he's teaching him, do not do anything bad. Like, the whole thing is set up to teach Abraham not to hurt his son, or to have empathy for Ishmael, or Sarah to have empathy for Ishmael. So
unless Ishmael needed to be thrown out to grow. Some kids, you have to throw them out of the nest. How about that? Who knows? Every child has to be treated differently. Maybe Isaac has to be held close. Maybe Ishmael has to be pushed away. I don't see this actually as a story about parenting education. But having said that, there is virtually no lesson in the Torah that you can't find a countervailing lesson or countervailing story. If you're looking for perfect consistency, then you have to go to the rabbis who try to make the Torah consistent, but the reason they try to is, you know, that it's very, very hard to do. So, yeah.
I have a question. You said that Abraham never lies.
I never said Abraham never lies. I said the interpretation here is, if you don't want to believe that Abraham is not lying to the you know, that will return to you, then you believe that he thought that they would both return. Otherwise. Yeah. What do you mean? I don't understand. Right. That's what he asked over there. Why aren't we more numerous? Right. It's a very good question. You can give 1,000 answers to that, but the simple answer is that blessing, if you take it literally, hasn't come true. Right. With what? Well, God blesses. You think that God's blessing Abraham? Seems here it's pretty clear it's through Isaac. But even so, it depends what numerous is. Do you have to have 1 billion people to be counted as numerous? Do you have to be, you know, many thousands of people? When he says the stars of the sky, no people are as numerous as the stars of the sky. If you read the blessing literally, it's impossible to carry out. If you read the blessing figuratively as you shall be a great people, then it has been carried out. So unless God says, and that, by the way, that means you'll have 6 million people or 8 million people or 20 million. I mean, I would say that to Abraham, if you told him there were 15 million Jews in the world today, he'd probably think that the blessing has been carried out. Right? I mean, there was him and his kid. Now all of a sudden you've got 15 million people. He doesn't say, I will make you more numerous than any other people. It just says, I will make you very numerous. And so, you know, it's a hard question to answer, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay.
How accurate is it that the Beit HaMikdash was apparently built on
what? Nobody knows. The answer is nobody knows. Traditionally, the Beit HaMikdash is built where the sacrifices of the Akedah. All ancient sites, all ancient sites, who can know? I mean, there's no way of proving that the grave Ma'arat HaMachpelah, is that really where Avram is buried? You know, it's thousands of years, so who knows? Is that really, for Muslims, is that really the rock where Muhammad ascended to heaven? It's thousands of years, so who knows? You can't know for sure. So, anyway. Yes?
Wouldn't Abraham's conception of God be the absolute moral entity, individual, who knows right or wrong?
That's the way the Talmud reads Abraham's conception of God, which is why Abraham did this. because he assumes that God is the author of all that is right.
But certainly killing a child, that is wrong.
No. If God is the author of all right or wrong, then God decides if killing Isaac at that time and that place is right or wrong. You can't say both. You can't say God's the author of all right or wrong and God just commanded something that was wrong. The point is, if God's the author, God gets to say. It's what I said at the beginning, I don't know if you were here, about how limited our view is compared to God's view. If you take the view that God understands, then it's like saying to a child, you're about to get a vaccination. To the child, that's unambiguously wrong to stick a needle in his arm. But you understand much more than a child does. So we can say clearly killing a child is wrong, but actually if God says this time this is right, who are we to say no? And we will return to this question in much greater detail when we talk about Kierkegaard next time. So I want to just leave that there. Anything else? Okay, last two questions. One, two. Yeah.
Did the rabbi say anything
Three.
About
yeah.
the promise that God makes to Abraham at the end of the Akedah is very similar to what he made to him?
Yes, he does, and we will talk about it more. Right, it's a reiteration of the promise, which we'll come to when we talk about why, whether Abraham knew or didn't know that this wasn't going to be fulfilled. Yeah, Francine?
Also the reiteration of the favored son,
right.
which is the basis of all of the problems between the way that God, as it is written, sees Isaac and sees Ishmael, between the management of Ishmael, and the reiteration, take your son, your favorite son.
Well, I just want to caution us again against assuming that that which happened 900 years before Muhammad was born, in fact, later determined the antagonism between Arabs and Jews. I think that that's a lot of retrojection. For hundreds and hundreds of years, nobody complained about the treatment of Ishmael. Then there arose a religion which based itself on Ishmael, and because there was other antagonisms, because there were between Muslims and Jews, don't forget, Muhammad assumed, just as the early Christians did, that the Jews would follow him. When they didn't, then the antagonism arose. But I don't want to put it on poor Abraham's shoulders. I don't want to judge Abraham in light of the subsequent history of the two people. We should judge him. You can condemn him for what he did to Ishmael on its own, but I wouldn't condemn him for what later happened, because I think that that happened for reasons apart from, which leads me to wonderful last advertisement. I'm going to be talking about anti-Semitism, its causes, and I don't know, cures. Why not? I'll say causes and cures, but really causes, at the next Lunch and Learn, and I hope you can join us, and thank you very much.